And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of tomorrow's world. Today's news, all bad. Every single time I watch Good Morning America and my local television newscasts, it seems I am given a steady diet of nothing but bad news. And, of course, just this morning, I had to hear the shooting of two men in a Dallas bar, and then how a gang rang the doorbell, and when a 17-year-old boy answered the door, he was shot immediately in the chest and killed instantly on the spot. Then I hear of all of the other violent crimes, the arrest, for example, of a homosexual who was masquerading as a woman, a transvestite, had to be quarantined because they said it, she, whatever, had tuberculosis, and they wanted to take this thing off the street. Why is it that today you have a greater chance of being a victim of violent crime than of being hurt in a traffic accident? Why is it that since the 1970s, the average young American boy has stood a greater chance of being put to death by a gunshot in the streets of our cities than the average GI had a chance of being killed during World War II? And why is it that with a 95% chance of never doing any jail time, people continue to commit crime after crime? The prophet Ezekiel put it this way: make a chain, for the land is full of bloody crimes and the city is full of violence. Why did God tell Ezekiel to, quote, make a chain? Well, he was illustrating the fact that crime touches crime, that each is linked to another evil effect, that there is no end to it, that we have nothing but crime assaulting people continually. Now, here at our offices in Tyler, Texas, every Friday morning, we have a prayer breakfast with a group of our ministers. Increasingly, we receive letters from people inside jails and prisons all over the country. And increasingly, we receive letters from people from the big cities around the country, grandparents, parents, begging us to pray for youngsters who are on drugs, people who have just undergone a terrible murder, some horrible, riotous mayhem in the family. A particularly heart-rending letter not long ago of a little baby that was left lying on a bed unattended during some riotous party where crack was present. I think the child was only like 3 to 5 years of age, a little girl. Someone came back into the bedroom and discovered that little girl had been raped and was dead. A little girl under 5 years of age. What's wrong with America's so-called criminal justice system? And can crime be stopped? What is the cause of crime? Is crime going to result eventually in the complete fragmentation of society, the breakdown of the infrastructure of society as we know it, the complete failure not only of the criminal justice system, which I think has already failed, and I think you know so too, but the failure of the police and other law enforcement agencies to do anything at all about it? When you consider that 70% of all violent crimes are committed by only 6% of all violent criminals, and that more than half of these are released to the streets after the commission of crime, after the arrest, awaiting trial. Of those, and remember that's now we're down to 3%, 20% escape because they're on bail or whatever, and they decide to go to some other city or out of the country or whatever, and they escape. And 16% of them commit another crime while they are released and walking the streets waiting for trial on the first crime. And finally, for every 100 serious crimes committed, only 5 criminals go to jail. Let me give you a few case histories that appeared in national magazine advertising in recent months talking about this failed criminal justice system. Have you heard about Carl Wayne Bunteon? How he had 11 felony convictions, 9 prison terms, served 15 months of a 15-year sentence. Get this. He was sexually assaulting a child. He had already had 11 felony convictions. But a conviction is very rare because, first of all, only 50% of all crime is reported. And secondly, only a tiny percentage of the crime reported is actually removed from the docket in the police precinct by an arrest. And next, only a small percentage of those arrested really come to trial. And of those, only a small percentage are convicted. And of those convictions, only a small percentage really go to jail. And of those, only a small percentage ever serve the full term for which they are sentenced. Most of them are let go by various parole boards, or even by court order in some states, Did you know that, for example, right now, 38 states in the United States are under court order to release tens of thousands of prisoners? So Carl Wayne Bundian, 11 felony convictions, 9 prison terms, serves 15 months of a 15-year sentence for sexually assaulting a child, is released for the 6th time. A parole board releases this guy for the 6th time. Only a few weeks later, he kills Houston police officer Jim Irby. Case history, Samuel Barnett, 20 convictions dating from 1969. He ends up serving half of a 12-year sentence for raping a 9-year-old girl, and he's released. Only days later, he rapes the same girl again, who is now 15, in the very same East Oakland, California garage. A case history, Alan Rose shoots and kills his own wife. He's arrested. He's tried. They sentence him to jail for 7 years. He serves 7 months. The men and women of the parole board review the case. The guy's only killed his wife, for pity's sake. They were probably arguing about something. And so he's out on probation. And then he shoots and kills his girlfriend. Case history, Donald Leroy Evans, a long arrest record dating from 1974, serves 5 years of a 15-year sentence for sexual assault. He's paroled by the men and ladies on a parole board. He's arrested later in Louisiana, and he confesses to have killed 60 people in a 10-year crime spree across 20 different states. Another case history, Raymond Paul Weiscarver serves 4 years of an 8-year sentence for voluntary manslaughter. Now, you know, voluntary manslaughter, they probably plea bargained that down from murder one, as they call it. But eventually, he's released. He serves only 4 years of an 8-year sentence, so that man's life was only worth 8 years, but actually, they let him out in 4. He's later arrested in California after he has been on a 7-month crime spree in which he committed 60 armed robberies. But, you know, 2 out of 3 released criminals are arrested again within 36 months. And if you want to know, 4 out of 5 state prison inmates are repeat offenders. We're talking here about 80%. A serious crime in the United States, arson, rape, murder, assault with a deadly weapon, will cost the criminal an average of only 8.5 days in prison. And actually, if the crooks just look at the statistics, they know that any time they commit some horrible crime, they've got a 95% chance of getting away with it, because statistics demonstrate that there is a 95% chance that criminals will never do any jail time at all for their crime. Another case history, James Poe, charged with manslaughter all the way back in 1971, 21 years ago. Plea bargained to aggravated assault. He served 5 years on probation and never even went to jail, and his criminal record was expunged. But in 1990, he went on a suicidal shooting rampage in Florida that killed 9 people. Why crime? Why does crime gnaw away at the roots of society? Why does it threaten to destroy civilization as we know it? For many, many years, as I have done programs on the cause of crime, I have cited the disintegration of the American home and family, the breakup of those traditional value systems that actually should be the fundamental building blocks of an ordered society. And I have shown how the Word of God talks about the family, about the home, and about these principles having to do with God's laws. If we would keep the Ten Commandments, of course, our nation would be completely crime-free. Now consider this. I can walk the streets of Cairo, Egypt, one of the most absolutely, horrifying cities I've ever been in. And I can say the same thing for a lot of other cities in the Middle East. And I could have my watch or my ring just present and right there visible for anyone to see. And I could walk through some of the most horrifying neighborhoods of squalid disease and poverty, of open sewage systems. Cairo was the first city, I'd seen several since, where I saw buzzards perched on the parapets of downtown buildings. But I can walk the streets of some of those cities in Middle Eastern nations, like Amman, the capital of Jordan, virtually without any fear whatsoever of crime, because you see, some of those Islamic countries, no matter what you might think of them and their religion, no matter what you might think of Arab terrorists or of the Arabs in general, or as a result of all of the fervent patriotism of the Gulf War and the feeling of many American people toward Iraq and toward some of the Islamic fundamentalists in that part of the world, you know, they have the notion that crime should be dealt with immediately and quite harshly. And they have the notion that perhaps they should borrow some of the laws that were given to ancient Israel and that Moses and a system of judges administered, in which the punishment exactly suited the crime. That it was an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, smiting for smiting and burning for burning. So that today, if you stab someone, you'd be stabbed. If you shot someone, you will be shot. If you burnt someone, you will be burnt. If you stole something, you not only repaid it, you restored it double. Now, the laws really do make a lot of people cringe, especially when they see public stonings, or they hear about beheadings in Arab world countries, or they hear about Arabs walking along minus one hand. I have seen in the streets of some of these cities a few Arabs here and there on a rare occasion in the teeming throngs of millions, where a man is missing one hand. I have never seen an Arab minus both hands. Does that make any sense? Should crime be punished immediately? People talk about guns, about gun control. I was having a conversation with a friend just recently who espoused some of the same idea a lot of people do. He said, well, I don't see any reason at all for anybody to have these real powerful assault rifles. And I thought, well, would someone please inform me what there is about either an AK-47 or a Chinese SKS or one of the other, like a Jungmann or whatever, one of the Swedish or West German or American, or the AR-15, for example, or something like that, or the Colt, which is only a 223 caliber. Are they more powerful than hunting rifles? And the answer is absolutely not. In most cases, they're nowhere near as powerful as a 270 or a 30-06 or the standard hunting rifles. Now, oftentimes they are identical because they're like a 308 caliber, which is the standard NATO round. Then people call them an assault rifle. Why? Well, because they are semi-automatic, like millions of American-made shotguns and .22s and hunting rifles like the Browning semi-automatic in 270, 30-06, and other calibers. Continually, people want to deal with the effect. And because guns do not kill people, but people with guns in their hands do, they want to do away with guns, presumably thinking that if they do that, with all of the millions upon millions of guns already out there, that they will deprive criminals of getting their hands on guns. You never know who these people are, these parole boards and these judges and these lawyers and these defense attorneys who are getting people off and plea bargaining some horrible, obscene crime. And, of course, they never pay much attention to the victims. Now, you and I both heard recently the case in California where after 11 different appeals, after 11 stays of execution over a 14-year period, this young murderer of two teenage boys who brutally took them at gunpoint, took them out to a remote area near San Diego, shot one in the back and then the back of the head. The other boy was groveling in the dirt of the ground. He was praying, he was crying, he was begging in the name of God, please spare me, please don't kill me. And the brutal, rotten, filthy murderer shot him four times, shot him to death. And he did so because he wanted to steal their car and didn't want to leave any witnesses to identify him because he wanted to go rob a bank. So the state taxpayers in California kept that guy alive, comfortably fed three times a day, wearing nice prison clothes, with access to the library and the hobby shop for 14 solid years. But for 14 years, those 16-year-olds didn't grow up to be 30. They didn't grow up to go to school, get a degree. They didn't grow up to fall in love and marry. They didn't grow up to see their sons and daughters on their knees. They didn't grow up to establish a home or a family, and their parents were deprived of all of those years, as they were deprived of their lives, while state taxpayers and all of the weeping hair shirts and breast beaters and all of the people with their placards saying, oh, it's so inhumane to kill anybody, just because this brutal, rotten, dirty, bestial, animalistic, insane character brutally shot these two men to death, we should not descend to his level, we should never kill him, oh, we couldn't do that. Isn't it amazing how people judge God? How they're bigger than God, greater than God? God says, thou shalt not kill, and he says the punishment, if you do, is to be killed. And people think they are more righteous than God Almighty. They think human life is far more precious than even God does, for pity's sake. Let's deal for just a few moments here in this program with the cause of all of this. What is the cause? Well, let me give you some rules on how to make this kind of a person come out of your home, because the home is the factory that produces some of these demented thugs who go around committing all these crimes. Rule number one, this is the way to rear a crook. Begin with infancy to give your kid everything he wants. Don't deprive him of anything. That way the world will believe that it owes him a living. Number two, always fight, scream, and curse in front of your kids. Set a rotten, horrible example. Number three, when he picks up bad words, laugh at him. That'll make him think he's cute. It'll encourage him to pick up even cuter phrases later that'll blow your head off. Number four, don't ever give him any moral or spiritual training. Decide that he's a little product of evolution and he ought to grow up to be able to finally decide for himself when he's 21. Number five, don't ever punish him. Don't ever tell him he's wrong, and don't ever spank him. Because if you do this, you might develop some kind of a guilt complex, and this will condition him to believe later on when he's arrested for stealing his first bicycle or his first automobile or decides to rob his first bank that all of society is against him and he's really just being persecuted. Number six, don't ever regulate his life. Don't tell him when to go to bed, when to get up. Don't make choices for him. Don't tell him to put away his books, shoes, and clothes. Do everything for him and go around picking up after him so that he will get used to throwing responsibility on other people. Number seven, do not monitor his entertainment. Have nothing to do with what he watches on television, what he reads, what he says, the companions that he picks. Let him get any printed matter he can get his hands on, especially peek at the centerfolds, and later on just go ahead and stack up the pornography in a garbage bag in a back room. Be careful that you always make sure that his food is pure, and wash his drinking ware, and clean the silverware, and don't let any dirt get in the plate, but don't worry about what gets in his mind. Let him feast on garbage. Now, next you can give him all the spending money he wants. Never let him earn his own. Never let him go to work. Never make him do chores around the house, mow the yard, help you with chores around the house, or repair work, or maintenance work, or cleaning up his room, and give him a small reward for that. Never let him earn anything on his own. Why should he have things as tough as you had them? And you satisfy his every craving, whatever it is. Can I have this? Can I have that? If it's ice cream, that's fine. If you want to go out and do this, that's fine. If you want to, whatever it is, see that every sensual desire is satisfied, because, you know, denial may lead to harmful frustration. And by the way, you know, your kid can do no wrong. So in any kind of altercation in the neighborhood, any kind of altercation at school, if the teacher calls, if the principal calls, if they expel him from school, if they tell him he's suspended for a day or two or three, just go crazy and badmouth all these people, badmouth the cops, badmouth the principal and the teacher, and of course the neighbors and the little kid that bloodied his nose, because you know your kids can do no wrong, so you always automatically take his part against neighbors, teachers, and policemen. That way he will learn that only he is right and his whims and caprice, and that everybody else is wrong and against him. And then when he really gets into real trouble, you'll always be able to say, like millions of parents do, well, I can't understand what got into that kid. I've always done everything I could for him. He's always been such a good boy. Isn't it amazing the way people rear children? You know that the home, the American home, is disintegrating. The divorce, desertion, abandonment. And that for all of the homes that do stay together, there is oftentimes unhappiness and bickering because selfish individuals who have no more concept of God's laws involving marriage and the stability of a home than the average cow munching grass are actually producing in the factory, which is the home, the kind of people who are out here perpetrating the acts that I was going through a little while ago. But the most important influence, we are told, is the peer group. And the peer group means other kids the same age. You're familiar with gang warfare. You're familiar with what goes on in schools. You're familiar with kids all the way down to the sixth grade doing drugs. You're familiar now with a lot of controversy about AIDS testing and whether or not parents ought to be informed all the way down to the sixth grade. You're familiar with 12 and 13-year-olds being said to be, quote, sexually active. But are you familiar, are you parents familiar with what they watch, what they read, what they talk about, where they go? Have you seen a great deal of TV? Well, of course, a lot of you have. We got a letter just the other day from a lady who said she was glad to get rid of her TV because she got to the point where there was so much sex and drugs and violence and slop and garbage and filth that she couldn't stand to watch it. Let's just take a look at that aspect of what we're talking about because, you know, judging from many anti-war demonstrators, from the outpouring of tears, fear, and anxiety from millions who were concerned about loved ones who might have been overseas during the war in the Gulf, and all the wives and sweethearts and others who were praying and crying at the dock when the ship left, you could think that America is one of the most non-violent, peace-loving, war-rejecting nations on the face of the earth. Well, like the country western song says, wrong. Let me give you a bizarre, ironic example. Did you know that 23,000 Americans died in 1990 as a result of gunshot wounds? But did you know that only back in the late 60s, that was only a tiny fraction of that figure? For example, there are far more than 1,000 murders in Los Angeles today every single year. 3, 4, 5 a day. Same in Dallas and Fort Worth. Same in Houston. Same in Detroit. Same in New York. Same in Atlanta. Same in Miami, especially, a city of high crime. The same in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. And yet, way back in 1967, there was only a tiny fraction of that number of people who were killed in Los Angeles. We had the crime clocks back then when I was doing radio and television programs and doing programs on crime and how it could be stopped. You talk about being like Peter in the dike with two thumbs and 47 holes leaking. That's exactly the way you feel when you deal with that kind of a situation. Did you know that fully 10% of these annual deaths in the United States, 2,300 occurred in Los Angeles alone? Divide that up by 365 days. And you see what kind of a violent society it is in which we live. You remember way back when Gone with the Wind was banned in Boston? Millions lined up two abreast around city blocks to see that famous classic, sitting in tense anticipation while they awaited the shocking, unthinkable moment when, for the very first time in film, the horrifying word was used as Clark Gable, playing the part of Rhett, looks at Vivian Leigh, who was playing Scarlett, and said, "Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn." And oh, they were so shocked. You can't watch the average political broadcast on television anymore without having your mind blown with some of the language that is used. I mean, if the Nixon tapes weren't bad enough, just tune into some of the comics at night. But worse, just look at some of the soaps. Look at what passes for family entertainment. Look at what is watched by children. Our entertainment, because we are what we think, has reached new lows in the last few years. Recently, for example, a 26-year-old novelist, Bret Easton Ellis, plunged so deep into the turgid cesspool of demoniacal torture and murder that he probably will emerge as the blood-crusted, slime-spattered, reeking, filthy, all-time prize winner of obscenity. He wrote a so-called novel entitled American Psycho, and it was labeled even by U.S. News and World Report as, quote, the most gruesomely violent book on the horizon. In a scathing editorial against that book, John Leo of that magazine wrote, and I quote, "This is not the sort of a book you would want to leave around the house. Somebody might read it. In it, endless numbers of women are nailed to the floor, then carved up, drilled, or cannibalized. And then we wonder why people do things like the man in Chicago that dismembered a lot of young men and left their bodies and bits and pieces of them buried underneath his own house. But in that book, in one scene, a starving rat is inserted into a living woman and left to eat a path out through her flesh." That was in an article on Society back in 1990 on how they were marketing cynicism and vulgarity. And, of course, we've got the new special effects technology now on motion pictures to allow these masochistic masses, like so many Yorkshire hogs quivering at the slop trough, to actually see knives slowly inserted into quivering, pain-racked flesh, to get to see huge holes seemingly spattering out of victims, and to giggle idiotically while all the viscera and the splatter movies drip from the wall. It makes you wonder. Is God outraged with all of this? I began this program by quoting the book of Ezekiel 7, verses 23 to 25, how God told Ezekiel, make a chain, and that shows the endless connection, how one crime succeeds another, for he says the land is full of bloody crimes, and the city is full of violence. Therefore, God says, I will bring the basest, the worst, of heathen Gentile people, and they are going to dispossess you, and conquer you, and drive you out, and move into your houses, and I will make the pomp of your strong to cease, and your holy places will be defiled. Destruction comes, God says.
All literature and tapes offered are available free of charge. Tune in next time for Garner Ted Armstrong.